There will always be books, if only because Hollywood would die without them as sources for scripts. As The Hunger Game takes aim this weekend at movie audiences, agents and producers who are doing lunch in La La Land should know that paranormal romances and dystopic futures are so yesterday. Meanwhile, Toni Morrison fans have something to write home about. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally. Every week, CCC's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show from his office in New York City is Andrew Albanese, BW's features editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
And it is well and truly spring this week. I mean, it's been spring or summer for most of this winter.
That's true.
But the calendar says it is spring, and with spring come book fairs. Tell us about the ones.
Absolutely. The book fairs are definitely in full bloom. So we just wrapped up the big children's publishing fair in Bologna and the Public Library Association meeting in Philadelphia as well. And in Monday's issue, we'll have more news from both. And for the most part, you know, I have to say it was pretty good news. Our VP and editorial director for children's publishing, Diane Roback, was in Bologna. And you can read her ongoing coverage along with her colleague John Seller's stuff on the PW site. And they've really done some terrific reporting from Bologna, where it sounds like it was a very, very productive fair. Now, Bologna is a rights fair, so that's what we're talking about here, a pretty brisk business in international rights. And as you mentioned in your intro, the word in the children's YA market is that paranormal romances and dystopias, you know, the Twilights, etc., have given way to thrillers. Little Brown Books for Young Readers, for example, reported heavy interest in a YA thriller, Alan Zadoff's Boy Nobody. And by the way, Little Brown had a really cool giveaway. They had pens that had a flash drive with a rights catalog in them at the fair. I love that idea, so just mentioning that to all the other publishers out there. And one final takeaway from Bologna that I think may bode well for the entire industry is that while concerns linger about the euro and the state of the European debt market, business is going on, and things seem at least to be stable. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out across the wider publishing market for the rest of 2012.
Well, of course, the issue that is a factor, the largest factor in the book market this year is e-books, or are e-books. And tell us about where we stand with e-books and librarians right now.
Yeah, so in Philadelphia, you know, I had a couple of takeaways from Philadelphia. You know, the good news is that more than 8,700 attendees ended up coming to PLA in Philadelphia, and that's up by a solid 1,000 over the 2010 show, which was in Portland, Oregon. Now, the not so good news there is that this was really considered a strong showing, and it was a very upbeat show, and yet it was still really well below the almost 10,000 people that came to Minneapolis in for the 2008 PLA, and you know, well below the 11,000 that came to Boston in 2006. So, and I think among other things, that's a tangible sign of the worsening budget environment facing public libraries. You know, it doesn't take away from the excellent programming that they're doing, and it didn't take away from the upbeat mood of this year's show. But I do wonder if PLA is ever going to see the kind of numbers again that it saw earlier in the decade. And yes, ebooks, as you mentioned, were very much a dominant theme. And unfortunately, there was no real movement on the issue for libraries who hope to lend ebooks from the Big Six. Now, the good news here, if there is good news, is that the lines of dialogue are very much open. And President Molly Raphael has done an excellent job pushing things along this year. And that's going to continue when Maureen Sullivan takes over the ALA presidency in June. She'll do that at the ALA annual meeting in Anaheim. So I had great conversations with both Molly and Maureen, as well as with Keith Fields, who's the executive director of ALA. And they do have a plan in place to keep the talks going and to keep the pressure on publishers to, you know, play nice in the ebook market. However, you know, I can't resist speaking personally here. And speaking just for myself here, I'm really not terribly optimistic that we're going to see any action on this ebook issue anytime soon. You know, in speaking with publishers, I'm going to stand by my belief that until we get further down the ebook road, that they're just not going to act, at least not boldly. So it's going to be interesting to see how this issue goes into ALA Annual in Anaheim in late June and where we go after that. A lot of librarians that I spoke to said they're very willing to try new things. For example, making people actually come to the library to download ebooks, which sounds absolutely silly, but you know, it adds quote unquote friction to the process. And the librarians that I spoke to said, hey, if that's going to get publishers to start doing ebooks in libraries, okay, we'll give it a shot, at least to get things going. But others I spoke to were taking a far more aggressive posture. What that's going to mean in practice, I'm not quite sure. But as this issue wears on, it could quickly go from words to sticks and stones. So it's definitely something to watch in the coming weeks.
Well, as you mentioned, it is spring and book fairs are coming. We've got something in this coming issue talking about the London Book Fair. And looking ahead, we see some other shows, too.
Yeah, that's right. London is right around the corner. I love the London Book Fair. It's one of my favorite shows every year to go to. In Monday's issue, my colleague and Deals reporter Rachel Deal is going to have her rights roundup, which is, you know, the London briefcase, which will detail what agents and publishers are going to be bringing to London. And as I said, I'm going to be in London again this year. So if any of you listeners are going as well, you know, hit me up and let's make a plan. And yes, also around the corner, BEA, which is also still one of my favorite shows. I know there's been some talk about challenges facing BEA over the years, but I think that they've done a great job there, and the programming is outstanding. BEA is a week later this year. I think it's in June, and this year there's going to be a Children's Day, which I think is great, and we just found out that Neil Young is going to speak at this year's BEA, which I'm truly excited for. So get ready. We're going to be talking more about BEA in the coming weeks for sure. And if I can go back to ALA for a second, which is in June in Anaheim this year, I just have three words to mention. Rock Bottom Remainders. That's right. The supergroup of best-selling authors is going to be rocking ALA one night only. So, you know, get your tickets now. And before any of this, of course, on March 30th, the Copyright Clearance Center is going to be holding its On Copyright meeting again in New York. Chris, I have to tell you, I love this event. I've been to every one. They've all been outstanding. And it's not just because I'm a copyright geek. I think that the program you guys put together is outstanding. So I'm really delighted to be going to a show again this year. And I wonder if you might take this opportunity to tell listeners a bit about that program.
Well, since you ask, I'd be happy to do that. And I appreciate your praise for past shows. We have been doing this every other year since 2008. We have a new location this time. We're up at the Columbia Law School at the Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts. And so that's, I think, an interesting setting because we've had so many legal issues to talk about in publishing recently, as well as around the media world. And so we're going to start off with a keynote speaker who will set the table for us, John Halkins, who is the author of the book, The Creative Economy. We call the show Advancing the Creative Economy. So the man who's sort of given us that phrase will start us all off. We've got presentations by Kirby Ferguson, who is a New York-based writer and filmmaker. Everything is a Remix is one of his latest works, and it's all about the value in combination and sort of inspiration leading to new developments. And he'll be on a panel that I will be moderating, along with Steve Rosenbaum, the author of Curation Nation, and Eve Sineko, who is director of publications at the Jewish Museum, and whose CV takes her back to several different roles in publishing in the early 1990s. So she kind of is a link between the publishers and a very important piece of their consumer world. And so we've got on the afternoon panels a technology panel. Now, technology panel, you'd think, well, there'd be a technologist leading that. But in fact, our own Michael Healy, who is the executive director of author and publisher relations here and joined us last fall, is going to be talking with, among others, Robert Levine, who is a journalist and the author of Free Ride, a fairly critical look at what's been happening online with regard to free and what that means to the media business. Also with Jonathan Lyons, literary agent, Ken Brooks from Cengage Learning, and Maja Thomas, who is with Hachette Book Group, and she's a senior vice vice president there in charge of digital, and somebody who comes out of the music business, frankly. So the perspectives that we have on offer for that day-long program called On Copyright 2012, I think kind of range across all the arts and sciences, and we look forward to having you there, Andrew, along with everybody else. If you can't join us in New York, you can see it all online at oncopyright2012.com. So that's my little pitch there for On Copyright 2012. Thank you for that opportunity, Andrew. And
oh, it sounds like a great program. I'm really excited for it again this year. So.
Well, we look forward to having you join us. And now we want to join us Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at John Reville. And as always, Rose, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Thank you, Chris. Today, as ever, it is a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you back. And you've got some word and some interesting new titles coming out. I kind of gave it away, but Toni Morrison has something new.
Yeah, she's got a new novel. I didn't even know this was coming out, but this is the great thing about this podcast is that it gives me a reason to do a real close read of the magazine's review section every week and find these little gems. So she's got a novel called Home. It's about an African-American veteran of the Korean War who comes home and goes searching for his missing sister. And our reviewer, she quotes Morrison's own prose and says, "The book is so beautiful, so brutal." So that's definitely one to check out if you're a Toni Morrison fan. We've got a fiction Q&A with Robert Gulrich, who's the best-selling author of 2010's A Reliable Wife, and this is regarding his new novel, which is called Heading Out to Wonderful. He says it's based on a true story, and he adds, "When that story was told to me 25 years ago, I thought it was the best story I ever heard." We review Chris Cleave's Gold. It's a very timely novel set during the 2012 London Olympic Games. Zoe and Kate are competitive cyclists and unlikely friends, and when the Olympic Committee changes a rule that would mean only one would be eligible to compete in the 2012 Games, they have to decide what means more to them, winning or friendship. And if you'll pardon the pun, our reviewer says it is a truly Olympic-level literary achievement. We have side-by-side reviews of Lucia Perella's short story collection and poetry collection. The book is called Happiness is a Chemical in the Brain, and the poetry collection is called On the Spectrum of Possible Deaths. And Perella is a MacArthur Fellow and a Pulitzer nominee for poetry. So the stories are all set in the Pacific Northwest. Our reviewer says they reveal a genius for plot and metaphor. And also Perella has struggled with and written about multiple sclerosis. And the poetry collection, again, takes an unflinching but not unsmiling look at mortality.
Well, there's some other poetry reviewed this week, and not all of it is in the morbid cast.
Well, there is a fair amount of death and dying scattered through the poetry section. Rusty Morrison's After Urgency is a quiet, melodious exploration of the author's reaction to the deaths of her parents, and it shifts between thoughts on death and grief and efforts to live in the present moment. And we also review Jane Shore's That Said, which mixes fortunes and fairy tales with real experiences. Our reviewer calls it deliberate, curious, and unassuming, and says Shore does what the best memoirists attempt in describing one life. She describes the condition of all lives. Mystery and thriller, we cover Jeffrey B. Burton's The Chessman. This is a thriller about a serial killer who places chess pieces in the wounds of his victims. I feel like this is a bit of a reach somehow, but the cops on the case thought they found the body of the chessman 3 years ago, and now someone has murdered the new SEC chairman using the chessman's MO. So Burton excels at balancing scenes of action and pursuit with deduction. We also cover John Katzenbach's What Comes Next. It's a psychological thriller in which a retired university professor suffering from terminal degenerative dementia makes it his last mission to find a kidnapped teenage girl. And Katzenbach keeps the tension high and avoids cliches in his portrayal of a man coping with the loss of his mind. And Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl is a tale of marriage gone toxic, which our reviewer says is compulsively readable and creepily unforgettable. And there's a Q&A with Brian Freeman, the author of Spilled Blood, which is about a feud between two towns in Minnesota. So he was interviewed by PW's Midwest correspondent, Claire Kirch, and she talks with him about scouting locations in the Midwest and growing up in Chicago. the science fiction, fantasy, and horror section this week, we cover Mary Gentle's The Black Opera. That's set in a magical 19th century Naples, where sung masses and operas can produce genuine miracles. And an atheist librettist is hired to create an opera that will act as a counterspell to one devised by a shadowy order of musical terrorists. We also cover Beyond Binary, edited by Britt Mandello, which collects 17 examples of genderqueer and sexually fluid speculative fiction. And our reviewer says it will inspire, delight, and enlighten its readers.
In romance this week, there are a couple of books that have some sibling pairings.
This is actually one of my favorite things in romance novels, is when there's more than just the hero and the heroine. They have families who influence them. So we've got a couple of those in romance this week. Linda Lale Miller, the queen of the Western romance, kicks off a new series with Big Sky Country, and it's an engaging tale of two half-brothers who are shocked when their father leaves each of them half his ranch. And the tension is compounded when one brother's ex-girlfriend starts dating the other. Carly Phillips concludes a trilogy with Karma, in which a cop gets a surprising amount of satisfaction from locking up the town drunk, because then the drunk's charming and lovely sister has to come down to the station to bail him out. In comics, we have The Complete Terminal City by Dean Motter and Michael Lark, which collects the 14 issues of Terminal City and Terminal City Aerial Graffiti. They're kind of wacky superhero stories that our reviewer says are retrofuturism at its visual narrative best. So it's about the 1980s as they might have been imagined in the 1920s. And the series was nominated for Harvey and Eisner Awards, and this collection makes it easy to see why.
And in nonfiction, Rose, we're back to death again.
And other deep thoughts. We review Jill Lepore's The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, which talks about how the cultural views of these notions change alongside changes in fertility rates and life expectancies. Moving from humans to animals, we have a review of Bernd Heinrich's Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death, and that's a fascinating exploration of the role of death and decay in the Earth's web of life. So, for example, he talks about how when whales die, the bodies can feed other organisms for years and years and years and really help to keep the oceans alive. America the Philosophical by Carlin Romano is a history of American pragmatism, which Romano says is all about confronting real-world problems and finding real-world solutions. And our reviewer says his breathtaking intellectual range and passion will make every reader want to be a philosopher. We also review Jonathan Franzen's Farther Away, a collection of essays that ask provocative questions about technology, love, and the state of the contemporary novel. And of course, Franzen is best known as a novelist, particularly for his 2010 novel, Freedom, which is quite the blockbuster. And these essays frequently touch on topics related to that side of his career. We have a Q&A with Daniel Duane about how to cook like a man. He talks about learning that cooking is more than just following a recipe. And there's another Q&A with Timothy Noah, who writes about income inequality in The Great Divergence. He says he was surprised to learn that income mobility in the U.S. is actually worse than in most of Western Europe.
And those dead bodies, Rose, I don't know what to say, but they keep piling up, even in audio.
Even in audio, we've got a big crop of mystery and thriller audiobooks this week. We have John Grisham's The Firm, read by Scott Brick. Our reviewer says that Brick captures everything that made the book so popular when it was first released in 1991. Hard to believe it was that long ago. Including the triumphant insouciance of Secretary Tammy Hemphill, who's many people's favorite side character from the book. Tom Rob Smith's Agent 6 is his third and final spy thriller featuring policeman Leo Demidov, and it's given a splendidly sardonic treatment by Denis Boutsaris, who takes a subtle and understated approach to Russian and female voices. Elmer Leonard's mysteries featuring U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens have been turned into the popular TV series Justified. But Brian Darcy James, who reads the audiobook of Raylan, gives Givens a spin all his own, creating an impressive range of dialects and personalities that even diehard fans of the TV series will appreciate. And Elizabeth George's Believing the Lie, the 17th Detective Inspector Thomas Linley mystery, is engagingly narrated by Davina Porter, who ably juggles the book's vast cast of characters.
And we have to disappoint our listeners and let them know that, to warn them, I ought to say that even the children's section, the topics are fairly morbid.
They are, and young adult fiction particularly. We have Summer of the Gypsy Moths by Sarah Pennypacker. This is a memorable, tense novel set in Cape Cod. Two orphan girls are alarmed when their guardian dies, and fearing being sent to another foster home, they bury her in secret and pretend she's still alive. So I guess it's Weekend at Bernie's for the under 14 set. And if that wasn't grim enough for you, we have Patricia McCormick's Never Fall Down, which is based on the true story of Orange Horn Pond, an 11-year-old in Cambodia during the country's bloody communist revolution. McCormick describes the killing fields, a refugee camp, and other terrible places with grace. She's never too sentimental, and she crafts a powerful tribute to the human spirit. In lighter fare for younger kids, we cover 7 read and play books featuring pop-ups, flaps, embossed images, and other interactive components. We have something a little bit lighter in the annex. We cover Cow, a Bovine Biography by Florian Werner, which our reviewer calls a fascinating and detailed picture of the universe of the cow. It's like my favorite sentence that I've said in the past week. And it included some surprises, including a brief but thoroughly distressing expose on bovine erotica. And there's a review of Agatha H. and the Clockwork Princess by Phil and Kaya Folio. This is the second in a series of novels that started out as graphic novels featuring loads of steampunk mad science. And there's a Q&A with the Folios in the works talking about how they moved from the graphic medium into print and text. And that will appear on PW's website as well. And this week, there's no pick of the week. So that's all she wrote.
I guess the editors just got too depressed and they decided not to make a pick. Whatever the reason was, Rose Fox, thank you so much indeed for the review of the reviews. Rose Fox, who blogs at Genreville.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And Andrew Albanese, as always, we appreciate your contributions to our special week ahead.
My pleasure, Chris, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Indeed, we look forward to seeing you and all those who can join us up at the Columbia Law School for On Copyright 2012. If you can't join us there, it's oncopyright2012.com. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, and as well as now, images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.